Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University History Department titled The Advent of the Anthropocene. Was that the big story of the 20th century? Our speaker is John McNeil, University Professor of History at Georgetown University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, History Department Chair Bruce Schulman.
Well, it's hard to imagine any historian better qualified to think big and to rethink the 20th century than our guest tonight. John R. McNeil is university professor at Georgetown University, where he has been on the faculty since 1985. He holds appointments in both the Department of History and the School of Foreign Service. A native of Chicago, McNeil took his BA from Swarthmore and his PhD from Duke. Both, it seems, under dubious circumstances. At least on his own biography on his website, McNeil writes, "I earned, or at least was awarded, those degrees." That is surely false modesty, because he's gone on from that educational background to author 5 books and edit or co-edit 11 others. His many influential works include Something New Under the Sun, an environmental history of the 20th century, winner of numerous prizes, and named by the Times of London to its list of best science books ever written. He's also author and editor of A Companion to Global Environmental History, The Human Web, and in 2010, Mosquito Empires, Ecology and Warfare in the Greater Caribbean, 1620 to 1914, which was the winner of the Albert Beveridge Prize of the American Historical Association. And his remarks for tonight, as you can see, are entitled, "The Advent of the Anthropocene, Was That the Big Story of the 20th Century?" Ladies and gentlemen, Professor McNeil.
I am indeed going to assess the meaning of the 20th century in the next 40 or 45 minutes, and I'm going to suggest that it may not have been those bloody wars, the ideological tussle between this ism and that ism, but rather something perhaps less conspicuous, but maybe more fundamental. I'm not going to say it's definitely so. I'm going to suggest that maybe it is so. So the question then that I put here is the advent of the Anthropocene, the big story of the 20th century. It's really three questions packed into one. The first is there really such a thing as the Anthropocene? Should we use that concept? And if so, here's the second question, did it begin in the 20th century? Or might it be older than that? And then thirdly, the stated question, if it did begin in the 20th century, is that the big story of the 20th century? So that's my general plan of action. I'm aiming to have no fewer than 7 parts to this talk. We'll see what actually eventuates. I may deviate from the script. Along the way, I'm going to say some things that to some of you, I hope, will be obvious. In doing so, I aim to firm up our command of the obvious. When I was a graduate student, I infer from what I see before me that many of you are graduate students. When I was a graduate student, one of my professors, a big cheese in military history, told me, when I asked him how I should prepare for my qualifying examinations, he said, "O'Neill," which was not my name, "O'Neill, aim to show a firm command of the obvious." And I thought at the time, yikes, he doesn't think all that much of me, and he's letting me know what he thinks of me, which may well have been true, but in retrospect, it's not such a bad thing to have and demonstrate and firm up one's command of the obvious. So that's part of what I am about here. So let's begin with a look at the concept of the Anthropocene. So this is the geological time scale. You saw this in high school. You've probably seen it more recently than that. And it's got all these eons, eras, periods, and epochs. Epochs are the briefest ones. And we are presently in an epoch called the Holocene, 11,700 years old. And the question before the geological community is whether or not the Holocene is indeed where we still are, or whether we have entered something new that deserves to be called the Anthropocene. And that is under active discussion in the Anthropocene Working Group, which is a subset of the International Commission on Stratigraphy, which is a subset of the International Union of Geological Sciences, which in 2016 is going to vote whether or not the Anthropocene exists. And it's going to be absolutely fascinating. It's going to be the most important vote of 2016. And I don't know which way it's going to go. I don't get the vote because I'm not a ranking member of the International Union of Geological Sciences. But if I did get a vote and I were voting today, I would say yes. So here's the geological timescale represented differently. You can't really make this out, but it's different from the previous one, not only in its shape, but because it shows what the geologists colloquially call golden spikes. Between two epochs or two eras or two periods, there has to be something that shows the boundary, something in the Earth itself, in the strata of the geological record. And these they call golden spikes. And for a lot of geologists, you can't have an Anthropocene demarcated from the Holocene unless there's a golden spike. Here's another rendition of the International Geological the geological timescale and the definition used by the Anthropocene Working Group, which those of you with young eyes can read. It's not all that interesting. Except, let me say about it, that it does not fasten upon one particular piece of evidence to say that the Anthropocene exists. It instead points to lots of different kinds of evidence. And I'll return to the significance of that in a moment. And it's not clear whether the Anthropocene, if it exists, should be just an epoch or maybe something longer and larger, like a period or an era. So whoever made this thought that the Anthropocene might be an era. Eras are much, much longer than epochs. So that's part of what is at stake. The geologists think that they are going to decide the issue in 2016 with this vote. They have clear and reasonably rigorous standards, although if you have a few drinks with them, you will find that they will admit that sometimes they don't really have a good golden spike, and sometimes it's kind of a transitional period that might last a few million years. It's not quite as precise and rigorous as they publicly pretend. Historians who use this term, small subset of historians, but growing, it seems, by leaps and bounds, are much less rigorous in their use of the term. And this is our nature as historians. We have no rules about delineating periods. If I want to create a periodization of the history of Boston University, nobody's going to try to stop me. Nobody's going to care. And if anybody should care, they could argue and come up with a rival one, and there's nothing I could do to stop them. That's the way historians work. We have all sorts of different schemes. In China, historians work by dynasty, for the most part. There's some exceptions to that. In the U.S., we've got this bizarre periodization. which is inconsistent. Some people would say antebellum, some people would say early national, and the boundaries are not precise and they're not clear. This is, as I write here, anarchic and always undergoing change. That's the way historians periodize, very different from the way that geologists do it. At the same time, all sorts of other folks are using the term in ways congenial to them. And there's nothing that the geologists can do about it. The cat is out of the bag. So here's in the highbrow popular press, that's the category I put The Economist and National Geographic in. Both of them had big stories on the Anthropocene in 2011. There's a museum exhibit that opened a few months ago in Germany, parts of which are going to come to the United States in about a year's time, and a handful of scientific journals that use the term and concept in their title. So the Anthropocene is colonizing intellectual space, whether the geologists will recognize its validity or not. Here's its progress in colonizing the world of science. This is 2002. This is 2014. And the number of published items that use the term, and it really takes off six, seven, 8 years ago. In the corpus of English language books, this roughly 2.5 million books that Google has scanned, you can see the history of the term. And this is kind of interesting. Somebody used the word in, I'm not sure if this means in the year 1960 or whether it was first used in 1958, I'm not sure, but it was used at least once. I can't find out where, by whom, or what it was intended to mean. You can't get that information from Google Ngram viewer. But it was used, and then used again in the 80s. But its contemporary usage spiked beginning in the early 2000s, mainly as a result of Paul Crutzen and Eugene Sturmer using it in a newsletter of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program. And Crutzen is often regarded as the coiner of the term, which apparently is not precisely accurate, but is at least the main popularizer of the term. Nobel Prize-winning atmospheric chemist for whom the only evidence that really matters is atmospheric chemistry, and it is the loading of the atmosphere with increased carbon dioxide that signals the transition from Holocene to Anthropocene. And so for Paul Crutzen, it really means from the Industrial Revolution forward. So that's the concept, and it turns out it's not quite as new as some of us would like, because it builds on notions of human impact on the Earth and life on Earth that go back actually to classical times, but were crystallized in the 18th and 19th century by some famous scientists, the Comte de Buffon, Louis Agassiz, Vladimir Vernadsky. And the guy who seemed to come closest of all was an Italian priest and professor of geology, retired revolutionary, Antonio Stoppani, who in 1873 coined a term, Anthropozoic era, not Anthropocene, but it's almost exactly the same idea, a period in the history of life on Earth in which humans exercised tremendous impact. So the idea has been bouncing around, although never getting anywhere like the traction that it has gotten in the last 10 years, bouncing around for quite a long time. So, that's part one. Here comes part two. Part two is really weird. When Professor Blower asked me to give this talk, which was like a year or more ago, She said, and I looked this up in the emails, that I should consider new chronologies and go beyond regional expertise. So that's what I'm about to do. My regional expertise is confined to planet Earth. But I am going beyond my regional expertise in this very, 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 very theoretical case about whether we should think in terms of an Anthropocene. So here's the very, 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 very theoretical case. There's a bazillion planets out there. I looked this up, and people who pay attention to this say that on the order of 10 to the 24th planets out there. And given that, that's a really big number, the notion that life could be confined to ours and only our planet is statistically improbable and one might say solipsistic. So let's assume that, yeah, there is life out there. By the way, I hate science fiction. I pay no attention to science fiction. This does not come out of science fiction. So if other planets have life and life evolves on some, well, let's begin at the beginning. Some tiny subset of planets might have life. And if life evolves, a subset of those planets develops intelligent life. And over time, if a planet has intelligent life, that life is likely to impact the planet the way that intelligent life has affected our planet. So it is conceivable that there's sort of a natural history of planets in which the Anthropocene is a stage that some planets, some tiny subset of planets, achieves. And that is the stage that the Earth is in at the moment. And it could be that there's a further stage where intelligent life prudently, carefully, and rationally manages the planet. And that's something that has not been seen on planet Earth and may not ever be seen. So, conceivably, there's this natural progression in the very long history of some planets. And what the Earth is experiencing is to be conceptualized in that context. All right, let's come back to Earth. Part three. So before I proceed with any of the arguments in favor of the concept of the Anthropocene, I want to make sure you recognize some of the arguments against. Philip Gibbard, who's an Englishman, works at Cambridge University, is one of the most eloquent voices among geologists disputing the existence of, or the utility of the term and the validity of the concept. So geologists sometimes say it's too soon. We don't know if that term and concept are really applicable. Let's wait another 100 years, 200 years, see what happens. If humans do exercise a stronger role over the biosphere and basic biogeochemical processes themselves, then maybe we're in the Anthropocene. But it's not. We're not there yet. That's one argument. Another is that it's presumptuous to suppose that humankind actually has such an impact as to warrant the term and concept Anthropocene. And most of what we do on this planet is going to be scraped away in the next glaciation, depending how severe and geographically extensive that might be. So it is presumptuous to think in those terms. And others, mostly the subtribe of geologists called stratigraphers, who pay attention to the layers in the Earth, they often say, if we don't have a good golden spike demarcating the Holocene from the Anthropocene, we can't use the term or the concept. Got to have a golden spike. So the geologists are pretty conservative about tampering with the geological timescale. And the last time they did so was 130 years ago, when they created the term Holocene. And they had more than 11,000 years to look back upon that epoch before they decided, okay, that's an epoch. So maybe it's premature to think in these terms. So say a lot of geologists. There are other kinds of objections. These ones typically do not come from geologists, but from other quarters. One of them is that the term, not so much the concept, but the term is illegitimate for moral and political reasons because it distributes responsibility for changes to Earth systems among the entire human race. The prefix anthro implying the entirety of humankind. And that is wrong morally and politically because it's only a subset of humans who are responsible for changing the Earth systems. Typically, in this argument, that subset is identified as industrial capitalists. And so we shouldn't use the term. We should invent another term that puts responsibility where it belongs. It's usually anthropologists from whom this particular argument comes. And then in an interesting and I would say morally ambiguous argument that comes from conservation biology, we shouldn't use the term because if we recognize that humankind has had a huge impact on the Earth and the biosphere, then it reduces the logic for trying to save species and ecosystems if they're already not pristine and they've already been altered by human activity. So there are people writing in conservation biology journals in effect saying, shh, even if it's true, we can't admit it publicly. Let's ban the term and pretend it doesn't exist because it would be bad for conservation biology. That, as I say, is morally ambivalent because on one level it's dishonest. On another level, if you believe in the causes of conservation biology, perhaps the doubtful means would be justified by the ends. Okay, part four, rival versions of the Anthropocene. So I'm going to say in a few minutes that we should consider it as a development of the 20th century. But there are a whole lot of people who believe in the concept and use the term who think differently. So there are many who argue for what I call old Anthropocenes, beginning maybe 15,000 years ago when allegedly humans wiped out a large number of megafauna at the end of the Pleistocene. Humans probably had a role in that, I think, but it's still a bit controversial. And so from that time forward, we've been in the Anthropocene. That's a bit of an intellectual problem because if we go with that, the Anthropocene began before the Holocene began. So that's really tough for the geological timescale to handle. Some folks, particularly William Ruddiman, who's a major voice in these debates, say actually it's 7,000 or 8,000 years ago with the expansion of agriculture and concomitant deforestation on sufficient scale to put more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and begin to change the climate 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. And that's by itself enough reason to use the term and concept. That's another old Anthropocene. There are a few other old Anthropocenes that I won't get into unless somebody asks me about them. More frequently, people who are converts to this gospel adopt one or another of the young Anthropocenes, as I call them. So least popular would be that the Columbian Exchange 500 years ago initiated the Anthropocene because with the transfer of animals, plants, and microbes from one hemisphere to another after Columbus, everything changed in the biosphere, and that's the key point of transition in the human impact on the earth, so we should recognize that and say the Anthropocene began in 1492. That's a minority viewpoint amongst the young Anthropocene gang. The one that Crutzen first went for, the late 18th century, the Industrial Revolution, circa 1800, it's all the same. For Anthropocene people, you know, 1783 and 1800, it's the same. For some historians, that's awkward. But in these debates, it all amounts to the same thing. That is, the onset of industrialization and the adoption of fossil fuels on an ever larger scale that began to change the atmosphere and to confer upon humankind a physical power that's unprecedented. And so the Anthropocene begins and is coterminous with the Industrial Revolution. And I have written things, or at any rate signed my name to things, that make this argument. But the one that I think I believe in more than all the others is the mid-20th century Anthropocene. And that's where I'm going next. But let me just point out that whether one likes an old Anthropocene more than a new, or vice versa, or whether one likes 1492 versus 1800, a lot depends on what kind of evidence you privilege over others. So if you're an atmospheric chemist, things look one way. If you are a biologist, things might look another way. And typically the debates hinge on the socialization and training of the people making the arguments, which is perfectly normal in human arguments. So, now the case for the mid-20th century Anthropocene. And I'll talk a little bit about atmosphere and climate, a little bit about biogeochemical cycles, a teeny bit about geology and the nuclear age. And I'm taking the view here, and this is consistent with the definition of the Anthropocene used by the Anthropocene Working Group, I'm taking the view here that a preponderance of evidence from a whole lot of different places is a sounder basis on which to make judgment than singling out atmospheric chemistry or the distribution of species over the face of the earth or any other single variable. So a classic case is a atmospheric case. You've seen graphs like this before. So on top is the history of carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere from 1850 to a little bit after 2000. And you can see that it's in the middle of the 20th century where there's a small inflection in the curve and the quantities of CO2 releases begin their constant increase. Well, that's not their typical increase over the years and decades that follow. It's not absolutely constant. You can see a couple of downturns related to oil crises in the 1970s. And you can see that's releases, and this is concentrations, parts per million in the atmosphere over a little over 400,000 years. So for a very long time, somewhere between 650 and 800,000 years, the concentrations have toggled between 280 and 180. And very, very, very recently, they've shot above 280 and are now a little bit above 400. So we are, so to speak, in a place that we haven't been for 700,000-800,000 years in terms of CO2 in the atmosphere. This is quite an experiment, as I think you're all aware. So that's one argument for singling out the middle of the 20th century as a key moment. Here's some other representations of similar and related data. Here's the CO2 concentration plotted. And you can see, again, the middle of the 20th century, a point of inflection in that curve as well as in the emissions curve. And here's temperature, where the point of inflection is really in the 1970s and 80s, not in the middle of the 20th century. And that's kind of interesting. There are arguments about why that should be. The best explanation is that there was so much air pollution in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s that it deflected incoming sunlight and had a cooling effect upon the Earth, masking what would otherwise have been the warming effect of higher carbon dioxide concentrations. And when we started to reduce air pollution in the 60s and 70s, the masking effect disappeared and the warming accelerated. That could be wrong, but it's the consensus view. So there are other arguments for the mid-20th century in terms of other biogeochemical cycles. So there's a carbon cycle, there's a nitrogen cycle, there's a few other cycles. You'll be pleased to know that I'm not going to go any further than the nitrogen cycle after having done a little on the carbon cycle. So this shows you between 1890 and 1990 some changes, and the big change is how nitrogen is fixed from the atmosphere on farms. Basically, this is the rise of artificial fertilizer, radically reshuffling the nitrogen cycle from what it used to be. Nitrogen cycle is pretty important. We wouldn't be able to feed about a third of the human population if we were not radically reshuffling the nitrogen cycle via nitrogenous fertilizers. We also wouldn't have had quite as much carnage in the 20th century without nitrate-based explosives, which, according to one estimate, are responsible for killing about 100 million people in warfare and other political violence. So these are aspects of the nitrogen cycle that are important for human affairs. It's also, changes in the nitrogen cycle contribute, actually fundamentally responsible for the so-called dead zones. Boston Harbor used to be a dead zone. I'm not sure if things live there now. I think they do. At least the administrator of the EPA, Gina McCarthy, likes to say that she cleaned up Boston Harbor, and I'll believe her. But in the Chesapeake, in the Gulf of Mexico, near the mouth of the Mississippi, there are in the Black Sea, in the Yellow Sea, there are gigantic dead zones, and overdoses of nitrogen are the main reason behind them. But let's not forget this, where I began talking about the nitrogen cycle. There's 2 billion people who can eat because of nitrogenous fertilizer who otherwise wouldn't be able to eat. It's the biggest piece of the Green Revolution in agriculture. So you can't afford to lose sight of that. Enough about biogeochemical cycles. I'll bet none of you have ever voluntarily attended a lecture with biogeochemical cycles in them, so I'm done with that. Geology. Another argument for making the middle of the 20th century, middle to late 20th century, the key point in the advent of the Anthropocene is our power to scrape and scratch the face of the Earth itself. Collectively, we now push more Earth around than all the glaciers on the face of the Earth. We push more Earth around than the sediment load of all the rivers in the Earth combined. We have become, somewhere between 1950 and 1980, the biggest Earth-moving agent on the planet. And we've also, this is kind of interesting to me because it might be a golden spike, we have put 50 million kilometers of tubes in the Earth in oil and gas exploration and production. And those tubes are perhaps a candidate for the golden spike. They will go out of production in a blink of a geological eye, but in 5 million years, 50 million years, evidence of them will still be there. And as geologists see things, this is really important. Future geologists 50 million years from now will be able to point to all that, all those tubes and say, aha, this is when humankind began to exercise its great influence over the Earth. So that's a candidate for a golden spike. The nuclear age, middle of the 20th century, as you know, the first nuclear test in 1945, thermonuclear testing from the early 50s, atmospheric testing all over the place until 1963. This is an entirely novel development on our planet, and it too leaves a signature in terms of radioactivity, most of which decays very rapidly, but a small proportion of which is extremely durable and will be in evidence for tens of thousands, indeed 100,000 or more years. So this is another argument for thinking that in the middle of the 20th century, humans began to change the Earth in durable and fundamental ways. So those are pieces of a case for the mid-20th century. Here is a general case which was pulled together by people at the International Geosphere Biosphere Program based in Stockholm 11 years ago. And they came up with 24 different indicators of changes to our planet, and then they plotted them all. And you can see here that the 20th century writ large is when things begin to take off, and the middle of the 20th century in particular. So they got a lot of indicators here, some of which I think are ill-chosen. I'll just give you one example. Yeah, indicator number 15, I don't know which colored stripe it is the number of McDonald's restaurants on the face of the Earth. It's probably one of these, because I don't think there were any before 1950. So my response to that is, okay, I don't question the data, but so what? What does this have to do with fundamental change to the planet? Maybe I'm missing something, but I think it doesn't belong there. I think this is a bit less rigorous than it might have been. And some people agree with me, including many of the authors of that, because late last year they did it again, a bit more carefully, I think. So here are a bunch of indicators, all of which show, not that you can make this out, even I can't make it out from a distance of 2 feet, but they all show approximately the same thing, screeching accelerations of something, either some indicator of environmental change or some driving force behind environmental change taking off in the 20th century and usually in the middle of the 20th century. So why did all this happen? I'm going to draw attention to three things, but there are a whole lot more things involved. But these, I think, are the three most important things. The first one is the enormous expansion of energy use in the 20th century. If I'm not mistaken, my colleague David Painter was part of this series back in the fall, maybe October, and he probably had a lot to say about energy and world politics and the world economy in the 20th century. And I'm sure what he said was absolutely right and brilliant. And he may have said something about the environmental significance of energy. I don't know. But the two things to draw attention to here. One is the sheer quantity, the tremendous expansion in energy use. This is 1820. This is 1950 right here. And you can see the subsequent decades. A lot of that is just the rise of oil in the world economy. But it's not only that. So sheer quantity is one big part of the significance of energy in bringing on the Anthropocene. So by my arithmetic, since 1800, the human species, has increased energy use by 80 to 90 times, could be 100 times, it's guesswork, and have burned in fossil fuels about 200 million years of photosynthesis captured in fossilized plant remains, and the great majority of that since 1950. So the sheer quantity, mind-boggling and significant. But beyond that, the fact that most of the energy involved, about 75%, has come in the form of fossil fuels, has its own kind of significance for the human imprint on the Earth and the biosphere. Fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, when extracted, create environmental changes. When transported, can, usually through accidents, create environmental changes. It happens much more often with oil than it does with coal. And then when used as directed, i.e. burned, they have environmental consequences, including raising the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere and nudging the climate in new directions. So it is not just the quantity, but also the type of energy used that carries this significance. Second thing, population growth. These data are, I imagine, familiar to you already on two different time scales. So this is actually a logarithmic scale, sliding scale on this axis. So this shows you 100,000 years of very boring population history where human numbers didn't grow very fast. And then in the 20th century, a tremendous acceleration. On a different time scale, 1750 to the present, you can see more clearly the significance of the middle of the 20th century as, once again, the point of inflection in the curve of increase. This is an unprecedented biological success in the history of our species. Never happened before. It's never going to happen again. No primate has ever done this in the history of primates on the face of the Earth. Probably very few animals, except for maybe mosquitoes and other creatures that could reproduce really fast, have ever quadrupled their numbers in the span of one century as we have done in the 20th century. So that by itself, sheer quantity of human numbers, is also one of the reasons for looking upon the 20th century as the moment of the advent of the Anthropocene. Before I leave the subject of population, I want to suggest how, again, anomalous, but also how fleeting this peculiar moment of the middle of the 20th century is going to be. So this is rate of population growth, which spiked in the late 60s and early 70s at a little bit over 2% per annum and is now in decline. It's about 1.12% in 2015. So there was, and this incidentally, this dip right here represents the great leap forward in China. Tremendous excess mortality in the phrase that demographers like, and also lost fertility in a 3 or 4 year span, 1958 to 61 or 62. At any rate, insofar as population growth is a driving force behind the Anthropocene, it's something that is waning, and if the demographers can be believed, is going to dissipate in another 50 years or so. And the last thing about population is the urbanization of our species. Very dramatic in the course of the 20th century. And once again, there's a point of inflection in the curve in the middle of the 20th century. But now more than half of human beings live in cities for the first time ever. 100 years ago, the proportion was about 1 in 6 or 1 in 7, and never previously in history had it ever reached that high, as this curve suggests. So the great majority of urban landscape, technostructure, such as you can see outside the window here, the great majority of that exists has been built since 1960. My last big reason is the pressures of the international system. This is what was the biggest shipyard in the United States in the early and mid-Cold War years, where a lot of naval ships were built in Baltimore. And this is the radioactive plume from a reactor accident in the Soviet nuclear weapons complex in the southern Urals. So world wars and Cold War. For the great majority of the 20th century, the big economies were concerned about military production and maintained military-industrial complexes and shielded, for the most part, their military-industrial complexes from any regulations concerning their environmental effects. There were exceptions to that, but not many. So this emphasis derived from the anxieties of international competition, which were keener between 1914 and 1989 than at most times in human history, and larger scale than at most times in human history, contributed to industrial production, accidents, and the unique environmental signature of the nuclear industry. Unique because it's going to be so long-lasting into the future. So the energy system we built, the scale and pace of population growth, and the pressures of the international system, I would isolate as the three main reasons changing the biosphere and the biogeochemical systems, cycles, to such an extent that we can justifiably say we've entered a new era in the history of the Earth, the Anthropocene, and did so in the 20th century. All right, I'm bringing it to a close. I have argued so far that, yeah, there is something that should be called the Anthropocene, and, yeah, it should be dated to the 20th century, especially the mid-20th century. But I haven't argued that this is the big story eclipsing other stories. And I'm not sure that I really believe that, but I want to explore it for the next 3 or 4 minutes with you. So could it be that the kind of stuff that Bruce was talking about just a couple of minutes ago, it may seem like hours to you, the political events, the First World War, the Second World War, decolonization, the fall of the Berlin Wall, this is supposed to indicate the rise of China, perhaps more 21st than 20th century phenomenon, that these political events were really the big story of the 20th century. And I think if you asked people who were alive at the, who lived through lots of the 20th century, this is what they would point to if they had to pick a big story of the 20th century. But what about maybe the less conspicuous but perhaps deeper social and economic transformations, of which I've given just three examples here. Maybe these, one of these, is really the big story of the 20th century. How do we decide? How can we assess the relative significance of these things and then assess them against the advent of the Anthropocene? Maybe it's a bad question, because these things can't be measured in some fundamental way. They are incommensurate. Maybe the answer changes depending on when you might ask it. If you ask it at the last day of the 20th century, December 31st, 2000, you might answer it differently than you would in 2015, let alone in 2515. Because things will look different in longer retrospect, partly because of what happens in between. The significance of things that don't change changes as subsequent things unfold. So maybe it's a bad question, but maybe it's not a bad question, just one that we cannot Answer. Ultimately, what I'm saying here is it's too early to tell what the big story of the 20th century is. Maybe it is the advent of the Anthropocene. Maybe it's not going to be. Walter Raleigh had this insight 400 years ago when he recognized the perils of writing contemporary history. If you follow the truth too near the heels, it may happily strike out your teeth. That's approximately the case. So here's my last concluding thought or set of thoughts. Yeah, I think we are in the Anthropocene, and yeah, I think that the mid-20th century is the least bad of the dates for the advent of the Anthropocene. If there's got to be a golden spike, maybe it's connected to the nuclear age, because those of us who were alive between 1945 and 1963 carry in our bones and teeth a radioactivity signature that is going to be extremely durable. Our bones and teeth are going to last millions of years. So future geologists can find the signal of nuclear testing long into the future, because we preserve it. So is it the big story? I really don't know. We can debate it, but I don't think we're going to get a good, reliable answer tonight, maybe in 500 years. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by John McNeil, University Professor of History at Georgetown University. Professor McNeil's lecture was titled The Advent of the Anthropocene. Was that the big story of the 20th century? And was presented by the Boston University History Department. Tonight's moderator was History Department Chair Bruce Shulman. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kahlo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us. We'll